Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Our sport is a risky sport.
We are at the mercy of the mountain itself.
Rock covered in snow and ice.
The risk of avalanches from bad weather.
Hypothermia.
Altitude sickness.
Exhaustion.
It's not a natural environment for survival.
Chasing mountains. Listen now by searching for amazing sports stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 13 hours GMT on Friday, May the 3rd, these are our main stories. The UN says the battle for the city of Al-Fashir in Darfur in the west of Sudan is proving catastrophic for people struggling to survive there. China hopes a spacecraft it's launched today will bring back samples that'll shed light on the far side of the moon. In Brazil, severe flooding causes chaos across the state of Rio Grande do Sul. Also in this podcast, why Turkey is banning trade with Israel, echoes from the days of protests against America's war in Vietnam, and why puppy yoga will become a thing of the past in Italy. We start in Sudan, where the year-long civil war between the army and the paramilitary rapid support forces is now focusing on the city of Al-Fashir in North Darfur, the last city in the region still under army control. The UN has repeatedly warned of devastating consequences as millions of people across the country have been forced to flee their homes. Both sides in the conflict have been accused of brutal abuses of the civilian population. Toby Harwood is the UN Deputy Humanitarian Coordinator for Sudan. He was in Al-Fashir himself just 10 days ago, and he's been telling James Copnell what he found there.
The situation in Al-Fashir and in the immediate areas, rural areas surrounding it, is catastrophic. What we've seen in recent days is a significant increase in complete lack of rule of law, arbitrary killings. We've seen theft of livestock. We've seen complete burning of entire villages. We've seen a big escalation in airstrikes and the tightening siege of the city, which has basically stopped all humanitarian aid getting in and has choked off commercial trade. We're also seeing, you know, a convergence of militias coming around the city, which has massively metastasized insecurity across a belt of localities to the south and to the east and to the west of Al-Fashir, which has started to make it very, very difficult for people wanting to flee the city to actually get out safely.
To put names to some of the accusations, is it largely the RSF and allied militias burning villages and then the Sudanese armed forces carrying out aerial bombardments? Is that the pattern?
Yeah, I'm a humanitarian. I don't want to get into naming names, but absolutely, it's a case of Arab militias who have been burning villages. Sometimes this is as a result of provocations from the other side. And obviously it is the Sudanese armed forces that have the air force, and they are taking action against RSF-controlled areas.
You mentioned how difficult it is for civilians right now. What options do they have? Is flight a possibility?
There are a few corridors left. As I mentioned, there are many of the corridors, the land corridors, are blocked because of rising insecurity and the converging of forces. But there are we have some national staff who were able to flee a couple of days ago. But certainly the options for people to get out are very limited, and people simply don't have the money to buy tickets on transport. I mean, the cost of fuel, amongst other very basic products, has soared recently because of the siege on the city.
To what extent are the United Nations and aid agencies able to help out, given the security situation that you describe?
Well, we have in place two corridors, aid corridors, one from Port Sudan, which takes a northern route across the River Nile and down into Al-Fashir. And we have a second route from Tina on the border with Chad. We've had some success in getting assistance through. Obviously, the military activity to the north of El Fasher put a serious stop to those routes. But we've had, I think it's 95 trucks that have got into Darfur over the last 6 weeks. Now, this is a drop in the ocean to what is needed, given the fact that we have well over 1 million people on the brink of famine.
The UN Deputy Humanitarian Coordinator for Sudan, Toby Harward. Turkey says its suspension of trade with Israel over the country's offensive in Gaza will remain until a permanent ceasefire is established because of the worsening humanitarian situation in the Palestinian territory. The Turkish Trade Ministry said all imports and exports would stop until the Israeli government allowed an uninterrupted and sufficient flow of aid into Gaza. Earlier, the Israeli Foreign Minister, Israel Katz, accused Turkey's President, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, of behaving like a dictator. Our senior international correspondent, Orla Guerin, is in Istanbul. I asked her about the nature of trade between the two countries.
Significantly for Israel, about a third of its cement comes from Turkey. That's according to information we've had from construction industry sources in Israel. And they also say that about 70% of the iron used in construction is coming from Turkey. So that is a significant relationship. Now, the trade ministry has been blaming what it called a massacre taking place in Gaza over the last 7 months, saying that this ban would remain in place until there is unfettered and sufficient aid going into Gaza. But there has been an escalation of rhetoric in recent months since the war in Gaza began. Until now, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has basically been carrying out a war of words. He has accused Israel of carrying out a genocide. He has compared the Israeli leader to Hitler. He refers to Hamas as a liberation movement. So this diplomatic war had been going on, but now he has taken a very big step, the kind of big step that the Turkish leader likes to take. He is somebody who positions himself as a defender of Muslims worldwide, and that very much includes Gaza. So he wants to land a diplomatic blow on Israel. He wants to increase Israel's isolation. But we also have to look at the domestic political context here. The Turkish leader has just had a very bruising outcome in local elections where his party was defeated across the country. There is overwhelming support here for the Palestinian cause. And I think he has been feeling the pressure from the public, this push to do something more than simply conduct this war of words and actually take concrete action, which he has now done.
Orla Guerin in Istanbul. Just once in a while, if you're lucky to live long enough, an echo from the lived past comes back to haunt you. That's the case for some older Americans today, as they witness the spate of passionate student protests against Israel's war in Gaza taking place on college campuses across their country. While President Joe Biden stresses the need to, as he says, uphold the rule of law, for some Americans, the protests evoke memories of other anti-war demonstrations, in particular against the war in Vietnam in the late 1960s. Stephen Bradley is Professor of Black Studies and History at Amherst College in Massachusetts. He's also written about past protests. So does he see any echoes of those times in these latest demonstrations?
When I think of the 1968 rebellion at Columbia University, I see many similarities. For instance, this idea that young people don't want their university to be associated with death or destruction. These students at Columbia or at UCLA or Dartmouth or anywhere want to know that the money they're spending is not being used to harm people, but rather to uplift people. So I think that's a major similarity between now and then. I think there's an overarching goal of their institutions divesting of funds that are being used in companies with Israel. One thing that's always important to remember is nobody likes to be annoyed or disrupted. And so people will always say there's a better way to protest and there's a better way to demonstrate. One thing I have realized in studying all these years is there is no right or wrong way to protest the deaths of so many people. What you seem to have is a contest between two major opponents. One is donors, a minority of donors, and the second is students paying tuition. And so the contest will be decided between those two. And in the middle, you have university leadership, which I think is not performing optimally right now.
Professor Stefan Bradley. A ship is preparing to set sail from France to lay the next section of the largest ever subsea internet cable. The To Africa cable is an incredible 45,000 kilometres long and stretches around the entire continent. But even as the world celebrates ambitious projects like this one, which gets more people online, internet freedom is under threat across the world. This report from our cyber correspondent, Joe Tidy.
After many years of planning and investment and then constructing the cable, laying it down the coast of Africa, finally we see it come to shore here in South Africa.
The promo video is triumphant, but these engineers do have a lot to celebrate. The latest successful landing of the largest subsea internet cable ever. Videos show engineers bringing the cable ashore from a ship, carefully dragging on golden buoys that are attached to the wire. These landings have been happening since 2022, and the full 45,000 kilometre long line won't be fully installed until next year. The To Africa project promises to bring a huge boost in internet capacity and resilience to billions of people in Africa and beyond. In Calais, France, a team is preparing to set sail to lay the next section of the line. Inside the belly of this huge ship, they carefully coil the white plastic wire around giant drums. The cable is surprisingly thin.
About the same width as a garden hose, and inside, protected by that plastic coating, there's all these really thin optical fibres, and it's on these that your emails and social media posts travel under the oceans around the world at the speed of light.
It's subsea cables like these that have helped get the world connected in recent years. 70% of us are now online, but it's expensive and high-stakes stuff. A lot can go wrong with subsea cables. Breakages are common. But thanks to a sophisticated system of rerouting, most of the time we don't really notice. However, the bigger threat to internet connectivity comes from governments themselves. Organisations like Top 10 VPN track deliberate internet shutdowns. Last year, researchers say, was the worst on record, with countries, particularly India, routinely switching off connectivity for everything from preventing cheating in exams to controlling unrest. Marwa Fatafta is from Connectivity Watchers, Access Now.
Internet shutdowns is like this blanket censorship. You are controlling and stopping information flows for an entire population or community, which in some contexts, like this, in situations of armed conflict or war, it can be fatal. You know, there are all sorts of economic, social, civil and political rights that are severely impacted.
Lives online are also being controlled in a less obvious way. Researchers at Freedom House say censorship, surveillance and website blockings are on the rise. Internet freedom has declined for 13 years in a row, they say, with Iran and Myanmar declining the most in recent years and China remaining the worst online environment. Experts like Jackie Kerr, senior research fellow at the National Defence University, say the trend is only in one direction, because tools for internet control have become abundant and governments are less squeamish about using them.
The idea that the internet is a global space that is a commons, that is, or, you know, it's public good or commons or some combination that's going to be beyond the reach of governments to control, it's going to be the same everywhere. You know, that was always a bit of a fantasy, but it also was sort of this knee-jerk libertarianism that was based on a incorrect understanding of how the technology actually works.
So even as incredible feats of engineering like To Africa are helping to connect us, the internet is more splintered and fractured than ever before.
Joe Tidy. Well, let's follow that look at how the internet is getting closer to and bigger for millions of Africans with a sideways shift to see how the words we use in everyday life are increasingly influenced by the technology that we're steeped in, none more so than the internet. We know that a lot of our listeners use the Global News podcast to improve their English, and we wanted to examine some of the more popular words and expressions doing the rounds. Nick Miles spoke to Neil Edgeler from the BBC podcast 6 Minutes English.
we have these expressions that seem to come out of nowhere, and often they do have quite a history to them. Obviously, viral is connected to viruses and health and those kind of concerns, but its usage, as we're talking about it now, does actually go back into the late 20th century when it came to be applied more to sort of ideas and things. So we have that sort of concept of viral marketing, that type of thing, where companies attempt to manufacture word-of-mouth popularity. But now, in the social media context, where we hear it most now, it's still connected to that sort of disease-type idea where something's unstoppable and uncontrollable. But the interesting thing here is that it's in a positive way, usually.
I don't like it as a journalist because it's not very specific.
Yeah.
Maybe from a learning English perspective, it's not great either because it's a bit vague.
Well, from a language perspective, it's just exciting because it shows that things take on new meanings and we've got no control of them. A little bit like the concept of going viral. This expression now means what it means, regardless of whether we like it or not.
What about if we look beyond this at wider trends or new concepts? How do we tend to talk about those?
For example, you will be aware of the expression to become a thing, meaning that it's become widely accepted or an acknowledged trend or recognised phenomenon. So, for example, we could use this to talk about items of fashion and then maybe looking forward into the future, something like a driverless car. So at the moment, we are aware that these driverless cars exist, but they're not really a thing yet. They're not a recognised phenomenon in everyday use.
They're having a moment.
They're having a moment.
Call it another phrase.
Yes.
Yeah. But in the future, not here yet.
No, that's right. And interestingly, we can also question whether something is a thing. And the expression that we use there is that even a thing? And that kind of refers to when you come across something and you're not sure whether you're just behind the times or whether it's a phenomenon that you're just unaware of. Another example, the word hybrid we hear a lot. Again, it goes back a little bit to the 1600s to talk about a mix of two species, but it's become more widely used just to mean a sort of general mixing. It's just a shorthand because it's very complicated and wordy to say something like, I've got a car which is part electric and part petrol. So we use the shorthand. It's a hybrid. Or when we're talking about new working practices, especially since the pandemic, we talk about hybrid working. Now, we had expressions before like flexible working. But when we talk about something being hybrid, it's almost got a sort of scientific stamp of approval.
It will be fascinating to know what our listeners on the Global News podcast think about this. Do get in touch. We'll give you the details again at the end of this podcast.
And you can hear more from Neil by searching for BBC Learning at 6 Minutes English. Still to come.
Power is important for this kind of people.
One African country is less than convincing. Return to the polls. There's yet another sign today of the ambition of China's space program.
三二一，点火，点火。
The country's space agency has launched a rocket carrying a probe that will aim for the first time to collect samples from the far side of the moon and return them successfully to Earth. In a struggling economy, investment in the latest international space race by Beijing seems undented. Brian Harvey is a close follower of the Chinese space program, and Paul Henley asked him what's motivating China to get to the far side of the moon.
The point of the launch of the Chang'e 6 spacecraft this morning is, for the first time, to get the rocks back from the far side of the moon. Nobody has ever done this before.
And what do they hope to gain?
The far side of the moon has a quite different geology from the near side of the moon. If we look at the near side of the moon, we can see the craters. We can see the black areas, which are called mare or seas. They are almost absent on the far side. And most lunar experts believe that we can learn an awful lot more about the history of the moon, its relationship with the Earth, and the origins of the solar system by getting rocks back from the far side of the moon.
China's space program seems to have grown faster than any other country's. What does it say about national priorities at a difficult economic time?
China put forward a plan for a huge expansion of its space program in 2009 called the Roadmap to 2050. And I don't think anyone at the time really believed that they would be able to do these things. The only problem about their schedule is that they've been ticking off the dates ahead of schedule, not behind schedule. And sending spacecraft to orbit the moon, to land on the moon, to send rovers across the moon, and now to get rocks back from the far side have been some of the main achievements that has undertaken so far. And this is paving the way for two more landers later in this decade. And then China will set up its first lunar base from the year 2030 onwards. And they've recently given us the designs and the methods and the rockets they're going to use for the first Chinese human landing on the moon, currently scheduled for 2030.
Is there a military motive to what China is trying to do? The country wouldn't be alone if there were.
Most countries do have military space programs. That is certainly true, and China is no exception to that. However, this is a civilian space science mission. Most of the work undertaken by China in space is civilian and non-military. For example, their other big achievement at the moment is the Tiangong orbiting space station, which has three Hang Tian Yuan, which is their word for astronauts or cosmonauts on board. And that is carrying out entirely civilian scientific research in Earth orbit at the moment. And that's another of China's remarkable achievements in the past couple of years.
Space expert Brian Harvey speaking there to Paul Henley. The ruling military council in Myanmar has stopped issuing exit permits to men who want to apply for work overseas. Millions of Burmese people have already left the country to escape poverty or avoid conscription since the coup 3 years ago, which displaced the civilian government led by Aung San Suu Kyi. Our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head told me more about the ban.
The government's saying very little. I mean, basically, they've suspended the issuing of permits to all men. They say in order to scrutinise and verify them better. Now, they haven't said this is specifically because of the conscription law, but that's the way everybody reads it. You cannot, as a Myanmar person, go overseas to work unless you get one of these permits. Very few Burmese people have passports. The only way they're going to be able to go and get a job overseas is through getting one of these government permits. And this is an absolutely essential lifeline for the Myanmar economy. There are millions and millions of Burmese people working in other countries, sending remittances back. But of course, the numbers have gone up, trying to get out of the country, have gone up significantly since the conscription law was announced in February. We've seen huge numbers of young men fleeing informally, you know, in an undocumented way across the border into Thailand. We've even heard of schools trying to get their entire senior year boys out of the country en masse, to avoid conscription. Nobody wants to be conscripted. Nobody wants to have their life put at risk for a military regime that most of them hate. And so it's been almost impossible for the army to recruit in other ways. And I think this is, they're hoping, a method that will, if they screen it, they can weed out anybody between the ages of 18 and 35 and make sure that they stay put. And they are conscripting officially at least 5,000 men every month, but there are all sorts of unofficial conscription operations going on in remote parts of the country as well.
And what does this tell us, do you think, about the junta in Myanmar and the pressure it's under?
Well, we know the pressure is high. They've lost a reasonably large number of troops, but I think, you know, the numbers who are wounded, the numbers who've deserted, the numbers who defected to the opposition, we don't even know what those numbers are, but I think their bigger problem is they can't recruit. It used to be relatively easy to recruit into the Myanmar Armed Forces, but recruitment is almost impossible now. The military is fighting very, very tough battles against many of the ethnic armies, and it has been losing, and it's been losing a lot of troops. And so even those who might otherwise have joined the military don't want to anymore because of the risk to their lives. But so much of the population is deeply opposed to this military government. Of course, the last thing they want to do, they're appalled at the idea they'd have to fight against a resistance movement that most of them support. So this is the only way I think the military feels that they can actually try and fill the gaps that are being made in the ranks.
Jonathan Head. A hydroelectric dam has burst in southern Brazil after days of heavy rain that triggered extensive flooding. More than 30 people are known to have been killed and many more are missing in the state of Rio Grande do Sul. But the local authorities there are warning that number could rise, with more rain forecast in the coming days. Brazil's President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has visited the region, promising help from the central government. The journalist Ewan Marshall in Sao Paulo has been following events.
The problem is, at the moment with these rains, is that they're not just affecting one or two concentrated pockets of the state, they're affecting more or less around half of the state. And it's an area of around the size of Germany. So if you can imagine an area of that size being affected by rains and flooding and landslides, there's just untold amount of damage. And the amount of damage that we're going to see over the next couple of days is worryingly going to be even worse. We're expecting these heavy rains to continue over the weekend. And also, we have a lot of rivers in the state which have reached all-time high levels. And as those flow down, these will now affect other parts of the state. They will burst their banks at other towns that haven't been affected already. We see the mayor of Porto Alegre, which is the state capital, it's a city of around 1.5 million people. They're warning that on Friday afternoon, they're expecting to probably have the biggest floods that they've ever had in their history. We've had dams, bridges, roads, all of these major infrastructure work that link these cities together, or in the case of dams that control the level of water, a lot of these have failed and collapsed, which has not only meant that it's a lot harder to get from one city to another and to get help from one city to another, it has also caused untold destruction in the place where these dams and bridges and roads have just given way. At the moment, we're just going through the tail end of the El Niño weather phenomenon, which has really affected South America and Brazil, and with the rising temperatures in the Pacific Ocean causing all of this increased rainfall. And the climate scientists in Brazil were expecting some severe rain for this period in Brazil's south, but nothing like we've seen. I mean, in some parts of the state of Rio Grande do Sul, we've only had one or two days of the month of May already, and they've already tripled the average rainfall expected for the month of May.
Ewan Marshall in Sao Paulo. Over the past 4 years, a vast swathe of Western and Central Africa, including parts of the Sahel, has been branded the coup belt. That's because over that time, 9 countries in the region have seen military strongmen seize power. On Monday, Chad will become the first of them to head to the polls in what, on the face of it, looks like an attempt to restore a democratic government. Critics, though, suggest the current military leader, Mohamed Deby, is simply using the election as a rubber stamp to transform himself into a civilian president. Beverly Ocheng has been speaking to Rama Yadi, who's director of the Africa Centre at the Atlantic Council and a former French minister and ambassador. Beverly began by asking why the current leader had gone back on his earlier promise not to run.
Because power is important for this kind of people. He has been into the power for 3 years now, but Chad's 3 years of government had one objective: to keep Mohamed Deby in power in the long term. Obviously, look, the violent repression and intimidation of opponents, for example, shows that he did not want to give up the power.
And, you know, having been a French minister before, how do you feel about the fact that the French president, Emmanuel Macron, had said that he had admiration for this electoral process?
This is the problem of France right now in the region, and especially in the Sahel. This region is now named the coup belt. The coup belt because the region has experienced many coups d'état in the past months. In Niger, in Mali, in Burkina Faso, in Guinea. Chad has never been named or called or junta, but actually there was no election after Deby's death in 2021. His son just took the power without no election. Many Africans, and especially the youth, the public opinions, considered that or blamed France for this double standard, because you cannot consider that what happened in Niger is a coup, what happened in Burkina Faso is a coup, condemn it, even threaten Nigerians of, I mean, a new junta of a military intervention, and at the same time congratulate Chad for the family transition and congratulate Chad for the ongoing electoral process for this presidential election. And this is something that is really, really challenging for France's credibility in the region.
The former French ambassador and government minister Ramayade talking to Beverly Ochieng. You may have seen it on social media, rooms of lycra-clad people stretching on exercise mats surrounded by puppies. Puppy yoga has boomed in recent years, along with similar classes involving kittens, rabbits and even goats. But the Italian government has dealt a blow to the activity, banning the participation of puppies because of concerns about their welfare. Isabella Jewell has more.
It's not often that when doing downward dog, you meet a yapping puppy. But for some people, puppies have become a cuddly accompaniment to their yoga practice. No longer, it seems, for Italians. The country's Ministry of Health has banned puppy yoga, classes which involve freely roaming animals. The trend has spread across North America and Europe in recent years, popularised on social media.
Today, my fiancé and I got to go to puppy yoga, and yes, it's just as amazing as it sounds.
But perhaps it's not as cute and fluffy as it seems. The government in Rome says that from now on, only fully grown dogs can take part, to protect the health of young animals and the safety of those attending. It's a decision that has been hailed by animal protection groups in Italy, who claim the practice is exploitative and stressful for the puppies. Dog experts have warned that the creatures are often not transported to and from classes safely and are sometimes not even given enough water. Proponents of the classes argue that they improve the mental well-being of those taking part and help to socialise the young animals.
Oh, lucky little baby.
But from Milan to Messina, yoga classes will have to say ciao to the puppy craze.
That tale from Isabella Jewell. And that's ciao from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chesney Fox-Porter. The producer was Mark Duff. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.